Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 27th, 2011, and this is show number 301. Let's back to business, guys. Now, no more fooling around with cakes and candles and backslapping and all that. Let's get back to learning about tech. All right, there was a lot of mocking last week about my ever so slight Macintosh bias. Fine. Let's talk about a really cool little Windows tool then. Here's the problem to be solved. You have some text you want to copy from one place, say a blog online, to another place, maybe in an email. The problem is that when you do that, all of the formatting from the blog post comes with it. A lot of us copy the text, paste it into something like Notepad++ to kind of wash it, and then we copy that text and paste it into the real location. Wouldn't you love it if you could just automatically paste without taking the gloppy formatting with it? Enter the freeware PureText 2.0 for Windows from stevemiller.net. Download this app, double-click it, and it moves into your system tray. You don't actually see it running anywhere. Now, go copy some text, but instead of using Control-V to paste, use Windows-V. You will be rewarded with a little bloop noise, and your text will paste in format-free. As Tim Verporten would say, this app does one thing and does it well. You can right-click on PureText in the system tray and select options to mess with, say, what keys you want to press to get format-free pasted text, and in that same options menu, you can tell it to launch when Windows launches. I thought it was rather polite that it didn't default to that option. So much crud launches automatically these days without asking. So I suggest you head over to stevemiller.net and download the free PureText 2.0, and happy pasting. Well, okay, that's enough of that. It's time to get back to the ever-so-slight Macintosh bias now. Kyle McGuire sent in a review about the developer preview for Lion. That's the next version of the Mac operating system. He's pretty excited about it, so let's have a listen.
Hello all, I'm Kyle McGuire and I'm fairly new to NoSillaCast. As you probably know, Apple released a developer preview of macOS X Lion, the next generation operating system. I have a very awesome friend who is a developer and authorized my Mac and gave me a redeem code on the Mac App Store for Lion. I've been playing around with Lion for about a day now, and I wanted to tell you what I found. Every week, I'm going to be back here until the launch of Lion, and probably hereafter, giving you some glimpses of what's to come. So let's get started. The new Finder. The new Finder is incredibly slick and awesome. The UI is fantastic. Here's one of the ways it just got all better in Lion. In icon view, and probably a couple other views I just haven't checked yet, all your files are associated with the app it goes to. So, for example, let's say I have a ton of PDFs. I would get a vertical list in the Finder with the word preview above all the files. And I would also be able to drag through them, and I'd be able to see, and it associates it with the application it goes to. So if you had disk images, is a case I was putting some applications on, it said disk image mounter, and it would group them all together. This cleans up Finder a lot, and it makes it more user-friendly. This is not necessarily a feature, but it's a bug, and because it's super buggy. This is a developer preview, I know, and which means it's pre-alpha. It's not even a beta, it's not even an alpha yet. Now, for example, system preferences crashed over 15 times on Apple preferences. These were Apple preferences. These weren't third-party. I don't have any installed. There's a long way to go at this point. Now, from what I've been gathering, it could be because of the age of my Mac or because I'm running it off a hard drive, and this hard drive I'm having is not the fastest thing in the world. Launchpad. Think of it, your iPad or your iPhone home screen on your Mac with folders. I did not check to see if it does pages. I would be kind of disappointed if it didn't do pages, but it doesn't sync with your applications folder. And what I mean by this is if I was to put, let's say, four applications in a folder on Launchpad, I couldn't go into Finder in my applications folder and see them all in that same folder. Recovery partition. Macs are almost perfect, but when they go bad, you can be really, really in a world of hurt. When you install a Lion, a recovery partition is installed. The partition is not accessible to you at all on your main disk. If you want to use it, you have to hold down the Option key on startup and select the drive. As of this recording, you get four options. Restore from Time Machine Backup, reinstall Lion, which doesn't work yet, because you need a disc, and there's no disc of Lion out there yet. Get support from Apple, which launches Safari, or Open Disk Utility. Well, this is all the time I have for today. If you want more, visit my site, kylegeek.com. That's kylegeek.com. I have more pictures, videos there, and I'll see you all next time.
Well, Kyle, that was great. I'm getting excited about a new operating system. I love the idea of everything not working again, throwing apps on it, and having all kinds of stuff not work. And you know I'm going to do it immediately in spite of trying to create the show. It's going to be awesome. Anyway, you can find more about Kyle over at kylegeek.com. Well, you've been hearing me yap about Screen Steps for a long time, and I bet you thought that coupon code would last forever, didn't you? Allowing you to procrastinate. Well, I'm still advertising for them as long as they'll have me because I simply love the product. And I mean, I'm telling you, I am not making this up. I use it at least 3 times a week, but the discount code is going away. You have just 2 more weeks to use the code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of ScreenSteps Desktop Standard or Pro. So you've been procrastinating. You can keep doing that, but you know what? You're going to pay more after March 15th than you would if you just got off your hiney and gave in and bought it. You know you're going to do it eventually anyway. Why not go get it now? Remember, it's still an amazing deal without the discount code. The standard version is only $40, and if you need the pro version, you'll only be out $80. For the amount of joy you get from this product, it is very, very well priced. I think it's very fair. Oh, and if you're not sure you need the pro version, you buy the standard version and upgrade for the same Delta price. So you can pay $40, upgrade $40 more for pro, and you're all set. So head on over to screensteps.com and give it a try. I've been a big fan of the iPod Nanos ever since they came out. I find them the perfect device for working out. The iPhone is great as long as you don't mind having a lead weight strap to your arm and having it slide down all the time and you enjoy fussing with the headphones constantly. The Shuffle is cool as long as you don't want to be able to choose between your podcasts or, I don't know, maybe you listen to music. I guess that might work. The Nano sits in that sweet spot in between with enough of a display to be useful, but still small and light enough to use for working out. Now, unfortunately, I've burned through 3 Nanos over the years because I managed to sweat into them. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Girls don't sweat. I glow into them until they die. Well, for Christmas, Steve might have gotten me the glow-free Nano I've been looking for. I know, it's a bit tardy to be doing a review of the Nano model that came out, like 4 months ago. But it wasn't until I'd used it for a while that I realized how very cool the 6th generation Nano actually is. Just in case you don't follow every little configuration change that Apple makes to every device, the 6th Gen Nano is now about 1.5 inches square and weighs 3/4 ounce. They dropped the video camera, which was a cool feature, but to be honest, I don't think I used it more than 3 times on my previous Nano. I guess since everything else has a camera in it, it never occurred to me to whip out my iPod. Now that the screen is so small, though, it's actually a touchscreen. It's not quite iOS, but it's getting closer. It does have icons on the screen, and you flip them back and forth to navigate the options. At first, that sounds kind of clumsy, but it actually works quite well. I do find that I have to do a lot of flipping, since you only get 4 icons on the screen, but it's very visual and memorable, so I've gotten into an easy pattern with it. One of the most important features to me is the clip on the back. No longer will I be sticking it inside my glowing clothes while I'm running and break yet another iPod. A while ago, I started to track my steps with a pedometer. I broke 2 of those before I got a good one. I enjoy metrics. I mean, seriously, who doesn't? And I wanted to get more exercise on the days that I don't run, so I wanted to really track it. It is a funny truism, but if you just start measuring something, you change your behavior. So I recommend a pedometer for that. Now, instead of sitting in my office talking to people, I jump up and I say, Wookiees! And I make them do laps of the building to keep me in shape. It's awesome. Anyway, now you're wondering if I've gone off the rails like Nightwise, because what the heck does a pedometer have to do with a Nano? Well, one day I was flipping around on the Nano when I discovered that it has a built-in pedometer. So here I've been running and walking with a Nano and a pedometer when I had a pedometer right there in the Nano all along. I did a test run to see how far off they were from each other, and the Nano recorded only about 300 fewer steps than the pedometer on a 4-mile run. I figure that's close enough. Who knows if the regular pedometer was right anyway? The pedometer function of the Nano is awesome. Not only does it record my steps, it keeps history back 30 days, and when you plug it into iTunes to sync it, it actually uploads your data to the Nike Plus website. I can track and graph my steps. It seems to think I'm only walking all the time. It doesn't give me credit for running, but I don't really care. I'm just tracking steps. One caution, though, running the pedometer of the iPod Nano does burn the batteries down. I pretty much have to charge this thing every day since I keep it on all the time. So now I've gotten into the habit of wearing the Nano kind of like a piece of jewelry. I wear it clipped on the outside of my clothes as I walk around work and home. Another interesting feature of the Nano is that it has a big, clear analog clock face as an option. Steve messed around with it and figured out how to get it to default to just showing the clock as soon as you turn it on, no matter what you were doing with it before it went to sleep. I actually do use it as a clock more often than I thought I would. I have a fancy pants watch on, but it's always upside down, and this one I look down and I touch the little dial or the little button and it comes right on. Steve also bought me two watch band accessories for the Nano. The one I like is called the TikTok. That's spelled T-I-K-T-O-K, and it's from lunatic.com, L-U-N-A-T-I-K. It's a big black rubber watch band, and you simply snap the Nano into the center of it. You can snap it right out very, very easily. One cool feature of the Nano is that if the face is upside down, all you do is pinch on the screen with two fingers and rotate it, and the screen turns the way you want it. That's very handy when it's clipped to your clothing and essential when you place it in the watch band. It's a really good thing that giant, clunky watch bands are all the rage right now, even on girls, because the Nano as a watch really is pretty darn big. It's fun, though. I wear it on occasion, mostly to show off how cool it is. Steve also bought me the Lunatic watch band from Lunatic. I know that's confusing, but they make two of them. And I don't really recommend the Lunatic watch band itself. First, they shipped it missing some parts and have been fairly unresponsive in shipping us the missing parts. Secondly, this watch band is intended for semi-permanent usage with the Nano. It actually is clamped into the band with a couple of long screws, the end caps of which they neglected to send us. It's cool looking, beautiful industrial design, but I don't want my Nano captive in my watch band, and I especially don't want it falling out because of that missing hardware. The TikTok band, the good one that I liked, retails for $35, while the Lunatic would set you back $70 if I hadn't talked you out of it. Another reason to get the Nano itself. It has a built-in FM receiver so you can listen to FM radio, or better yet, in my case, you can listen to the TVs at the gym since they broadcast over FM. Oddly, you can pause live audio in the FM receiver mode, which confused the heck out of me when I accidentally pressed the pause the audio button from a TV show once, and I couldn't figure out why the lips and voice weren't in sync on the TV when I got it going again. The iPod Nano has full support for voiceover as well, so everyone can play. It'll also show photos, but the screen is so small, I don't think that's a huge selling point, but might be fun. Oh, and finally, somebody told me it plays music too, but, you know, I haven't tested that, of course. Podcast for the win! The Nano comes in 8 and 16 gigabyte models. I got the 8, because I don't put music on it. And let's see, they run $150 and $180 respectively, and it comes in 7 colors. That's if you count black as a color. Now, Bob Cassidy wrote in and explained that the click wheel on his Nano had died. That's one of the older model ones. And he had heard that I was using my iPhone as an iPod. Who was it again who mocked me for not thinking of that? I think it was Nightwise, wasn't it? Anyway, Bob wanted advice on how I figured out how to carry the iPhone around exercising and doing yard work and other chores. In his pocket, he can't get to the controls easily when he misses something or needs to choose another podcast. He's also annoyed by the dangling headphones and wishes he could use his lanyard headphones again. Those lanyards were awesome on the original Nanos until they moved the connectors. Well, Bob, I'm afraid you can tell from listening to my Nano review that I simply stopped using the iPhone as an iPod the minute I got the clip-on Nano. The iPhone is just too huge to carry around as an iPod for me, and the clip of the Nano makes it so much easier to have with me at all times. The headphones are still annoying. I still prefer the lanyards. But often I'll just clip the iPod up at my collar on the outside so it's away from the glow, and then tuck the headphones inside my shirt so they're out of my way. I know you were trying to get away from spending more money, Bob, but that's the way we roll around here at the No Silicast. We aim to empty your pocketbook one gadget or one piece of software at a time. You know, I've been using Text Expander from Smile forever, so it's really fun to finally get to advertise for them. Text Expander allows you to type just a few characters or snippets, and they expand into words, long sentences, or even paragraphs that you define. It's in the top five applications I load on my Macs when I get a new one or reinstall the OS, because I know investing that small amount of time to get that done early will save me tons of time and keystrokes in the long run. Just in case you doubt that Text Expander saves you time, they provide statistics to prove it. Have I mentioned how much I love data before? I think I might have. Well, you may recall that I put a new SSD in my MacBook Pro that Steve got me for Christmas. Yay, Steve! On which I put Snow Leopard so I could boot from it. I also put all of my applications on the SSD, including Text Expander, fresh and new in late December. So here we are, 2 months worth on this install, right? I just checked my stats, and I have expanded, in those 2 months, 3,782 snippets, saving 122,922 characters. Now, assuming I type 60 words per minute, which is pretty close, and you can actually adjust that to see, I have saved 6.83 hours in just 2 months using Text Expander. Well, if you'd like to speed up all of your typing, just click the link in the show notes to the Smile website for 15% off of Text Expander and many other fine products from Smile. Now, this offer's only good till March 15th too, so get it when the pricing is good. If you're lazy, you can just click on the giant Smile logo over on podfeet.com to get the discount too. Or we'll make it even easier. Your last option is to go to smilesoftware.com and type in the coupon code. It's NOSILLACAST211. That's all capital letters, NOSILLACAST211, to get 15% off of all, well, most all of the Smile software over there, including Text Expander. So some of our Nosilla castaways are more vocal than others. Rose comes to mind. But we have a listener named Paul from Peru, and he's been quietly sitting in the background for many years. He writes me letters about his life in Peru as an engineering student, and we have chats about all kinds of technology challenges. It's been a lot of fun getting to know him. He is breaking out of his shell now, though. He started his own podcast. He sent in a promo for it, and I'd like to play that for you right now.
We're just happy to be doing good works.
Equality. Got a distress call coming in, some folks asking for help.
Really?
It's not something we should be striving for.
You should sit down.
We'll just leave the captain in, so
get back to shooting. The only way to help those
citizens is like gravity. We need it to stand on this earth as men and women.
I'm right behind you, baby.
Who the hell are you?
We are The Signal.
A podcast all about Firefly and Serenity.
There's the truth of The Signal.
It's Jane being so generous with this cut that confuses and frightens me.
It does kind of freeze the blood.
On our shows, you will find features, news, reviews, interviews, articles, and anything else we can think of relating to the verse of Firefly and Serenity.
It's going
to
be an all-day event. They've got Browncoat's Redemption. They've got Dr. Horrible.
We're continuing to explore the verse, and we want you to join us. Just go to www.serenityfirefly.com.
The Signal. We're just happy to be doing good works.
What was that?
I did one more interview at Macworld with the president and founder of a company called LensPen, but there were two reasons I never played it or showed it to you. First of all, the interview ran really, really long, when the product could be described in about 2 minutes. Well, we'll see if I get it done in 2 minutes, but anyway, the product he was demoing is called the Sidekick. It's a matchbook-sized thing that you pull apart, and a lever kind of springs out, revealing a black square thingy. That square area is covered with carbon, and you rub it around on your iPad to remove smudges. He explained that the carbon is the real trick to the device, and that after a while, the carbon will get full of oils, and you simply pop on a new cartridge, and you're cleaning again. That all sounded really cool, but the second reason I didn't show you the video was that it took him forever to remove the smudges from his screen during the demo using the Sidekick. I didn't say anything mean to him, I just acted all enthusiastic. But as he walked away, he gave Steve and I each one of the Sidekicks, and we're thinking, man, what are we going to do with these? Well, I wrote it off until this week when I was just goofing around in my office and I decided to open the Sidekick just for kicks. Kicks, get it? Anyway, guess what? It worked great. I think that the guy hadn't taken his own advice and changed out his cartridge after a day of doing greasy fingerprint removal as demos. So now I want to tell you more about it. It's, first of all, very pleasing to hold in the hand. It has this sort of soft, felty sort of feel to it. It has rounded corners, and it's very light, so it's easy to throw in a purse or pocket. I'm not sure I would carry it around, though. It's easier to cram a lens cleaning cloth into the Apple case, and that works almost as well. I'm keeping mine on my desk at work because it's fun to play with and pop in and out of the case. The Sidekick is much more fun to use than a cloth, though. I think because it's square and it feels really good to go back and forth methodically in all of the corners cleaning out fingerprints. I do wish it picked up the dust a little bit better, but it does okay at that. I gave Steve's to my friend Diane, and she was thrilled with it. Now here's the bad news. The Sidekick is listed as coming soon on their website over at lenspen.com. I thought it'd be really mean to tell you about the Sidekick without letting you buy one, but I do have some good news. Their flagship product is called the Lens Pen itself, so I bought one of those to try it. The Lens Pen is actually for your camera. It's a very light pen that has a brush on one end, and on the other end it has this tiny little flexible suction cup-looking thingy covered with, you guessed it, carbon. I tested it on one of my lenses, and it was really nice. It allowed me to get all the way out to the edges, much easier and much more successful than using a shirt sleeve to clean a lens. Now, you can't buy the Sidekick yet, but it should retail at around $20 when it's available. The good news is that you can buy the Lens Pen. I put an affiliate link in the show notes to buy it on Amazon for only $6.42. Definitely a good addition to your camera bag, I think. Now, I should mention, I did want to thank everyone for how many purchases people made using my affiliate link to Amazon over the holidays. Unfortunately, I don't know whether you guys have spent money until two months after you've done it, but you guys were really good about doing your Christmas shopping on Amazon by clicking the Amazon search box on my homepage and just searching for whatever you wanted and getting the same price for you, but a little bit of kickback to me. So I do want to thank you guys for remembering to do that. I know it's kind of a hassle, but it really does make a difference to the show. This is so sad. There's nothing wrong with my car. There's nothing wrong with Steve's. There's nothing wrong with Kyle's car. There's nothing wrong with Lindsay's car. So how am I supposed to do a How to Bob ad? I don't even have a nutball like Nightwise here to make up some bizarre reference to Septicons or something like that. Oh, wait. No, I do have an idea. A few weeks ago, Robert Lockman of PhotographyInTheMac.com and his lovely wife, Lorelei, were over at our house. It was great. I got to wax one of their cars, and they were just talking about how they wanted to buy a new car while we were messing around. They said they planned to buy a Honda or an Acura just so Honda Bob could take care of their car. How's that for an endorsement? Well, if you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hjbob@aol.com. HJ Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, I have a great security light subject for this week. So remember a few months ago I told you all about LastPass and how there's no excuse for having stupid, easy-to-discover passwords or worse yet, reusing the same password? Well, I took it to heart myself and I changed all of my critical passwords. No two are alike. Anything that's materially important to me has a unique, complex password. My email, my bank accounts, PayPal, Amazon, everything important was safe. Except for one, Skype. Now, Skype doesn't seem like that big of a deal. I mean, if it got compromised, you know, what the heck, I could just pick a new login name, let the few people who know my name there know, and I'd be back in business, because I don't actually use it that much. I only use it for doing podcast recordings, and I usually tell the person before we start to record what my name is. But I forgot one important thing. I had loaded $25 into my Skype account so I could use it for Skype Out. That's the ability to call real phone numbers from my computer. I use this very, very rarely, but once in a while, it's kind of handy to have around. Now, that wouldn't be that big of a problem, except in a brainless moment, I pushed a button that said it was okay to reload my Skype account whenever I got below $2 left in my account. That basically meant that anyone who got access to my Skype account had the ability to spend money like a drunken sailor because it would pull it from my PayPal account. So Saturday morning, when I got back from the gym, 7 transactions had occurred, pulling $25 twice and then $10 5 more times as some hairball made calls to Afghanistan, Egypt, and I think the Dominican Republic. This hairball gave drunken sailors a bad name. When I figured out what was happening, I contacted Skype immediately via their live chat capability, and my little friend Roy came on to help me. The first step was to change my password. Duh! What an idiot. Hadn't thought of that on my own. While we worked on this, even after he had me categorically state that I was not making these calls, my account balance continued to dwindle. I had $850 in it when we started, but by the time we were done talking, it was down to zero. Now here's the really bad news. Roy told me to pound sand about the $125 I had lost. He said it was my problem and started pasting in paragraphs about, you should be using antivirus and don't click on links in email and that sort of crap. Excuse my French, but I was furious. He basically told me to go complain to my bank. Now, at this point, I tried to explain that I didn't even click on the Skype link that said all this money was being pulled from my account because I'm too smart to click on links and emails. Well, I requested to speak to a supervisor, and after three times requesting it, he put Krenelisa on with me. Isn't that a cool name, though, Krenelisa? Anyway, as soon as he put her on, he disconnected us both because he got off, and apparently that kicked Krenelisa off. Yeah, after all our conversation from 8:56 a.m. to 9:20, all of that was lost. Or so I thought. It turns out they do keep the chat record, so that's really good. But you can imagine how happy I was at this point. You can go read my tweets from that time to hear my attitude about Skype. I recontacted their Skype chat, and after badgering the latest poor person to get me that got stuck with me on the line, I was able to get Krenelisa back with me. In between the two calls, the first time and the second time in the chat, I should say, I entered fraud claims on the 7 transactions through PayPal, which was actually a pretty easy process. By the time I got Krenelisa back on chat, she wasn't a lot more helpful than Roy, but I did get her in writing to say at 10:24 a.m., this will be returned to you in the full amount of $100 as a consequence of the chargeback you have filed. So far, the money's not back in my account, but I have her quote. The Skype site says those charges are marked fraudulent, so I'm cautiously optimistic. Now, you will note that I said she said $100. I'm still out $25 for the initial balance, and I couldn't even get them to give me the $8 that drained from my account while I was chatting with Roy. But I guess $25 is a small price for me to learn a rather valuable lesson. I think as a general rule, allowing one account to drain into another automatically is a recipe for disaster. So, if you haven't gone through and fixed up your passwords and used a free tool like LastPass to make strong ones, then please set down your MP3 player and race over to LastPass.com, create a free account, and change all your passwords, even if you think they're not that important. And from now on, I am not clicking that auto-load or auto-renew button ever again. Well, let's clean our palate with some good news on the security front. You know, Bart and I, as a sign of solidarity, have been irritated for Apple's lack of attention to security over the years. Charlie Miller is probably the best-known researcher who regularly reveals Apple bugs and is well-known for winning the Pwn-to-Own contest by exploiting vulnerabilities that Apple has left wide open. Now, how is this good news? Well, Apple has given developer release copies of the new Lion operating system to several security experts, including Charlie Miller, and invited them to bang away on it. Isn't that awesome? Now, hopefully they'll listen to these guys when they actually find the holes and do something about it. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this time it is, it's Chit Chat Across the Hallway and the Country. I have two guests on the show today. I've been really intrigued with how SSDs work, the new solid state drives, and read a little bit about hearing that they slow down over time. And I thought, who should I bring on the show better than John F. Braun from the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab to explain it to me? How are you doing today, John?
Fantastic. And I was going to say, I was confused by the name of this. There's no doubt at least one pond between Connecticut and California.
There you go. There's got to be a pond in there somewhere.
We're not across the big pond, but we're across. So we're going across at least one pond.
There you go. So I was, to be honest, afraid to ask John these questions on my own. So I brought in some adult supervision to help me. I have Steve on the line here, too. Steve of the No Silicast podcast, I guess we'd have to say. Right, Steve?
Yes, Allison. Thanks for having me on your show finally after 300 episodes.
You've never been on Chit Chat Across the Pond?
I think this is a first for me.
Oh, so, well, Connor will let us know if we're wrong.
I'm pretty sure I'm right. All right. But it's a pleasure to be here.
So if we have time, we have a second subject, but we want to dig in a little bit. So when I went to pick out an SSD for my MacBook Pro to replace my optical drive, I went online and I started seeing these reports about some SSDs getting slower, and supposedly the Mercury Extreme that I chose doesn't do it as much as others. So, John, what's the story here? Why would this be true?
Well, I think we want to start. Let's go back to how regular drives work, because I think there's a parallel. It happens for a different reason on SSDs, but let's review what happens with mechanical drives. So let's assume you get a mechanical drive, or they call it now rotational drive. If you go into System Profiler, you'll see they now have a classification, which surprised me now. It'll say rotational, or I call it mechanical, or I think it's solid state or electronic. So the thing is, with a normal drive, what you have is a platter and a head. And when the drive is fresh, everything's great, because when it writes out a file, when the operating system tells it to, the best situation, the best case, is writing out blocks on the drive that are all next to each other. And of course, if the drive is empty, then that happens naturally. It's right, and the head doesn't really have to move unless it needs to go to another track, if you imagine, you know, like a record. So that's the ideal situation with a mechanical drive. Now, the problem is, as you start using the drive more and more, and why I'm saying this is because there's a parallel with SSDs, as you use the drive more and more, you're probably going to be not only creating files, but deleting files. And eventually, you're going to get to a point where you can imagine there are going to be holes. There's going to be, eventually, the more and more you use the drive and you delete files, whether they be large or small, you're going to get, it's going to be like a jigsaw puzzle. You're going to have more and more trouble finding a contiguous area of space in which to write a file. And that's when the hard drive
disk fragmentation
starts,
right?
Exactly. And that's when the disk starts slowing down.
Because it's doing too much work trying to find space?
Well, yeah, because it has a list of areas on the disk that it knows there is space. And unfortunately, yeah, as you use the drive more and more, the possibility of getting, you know, a big wide area of space to write a big file is going to go away. So the head has to move around, and as the head moves around, that slows you down. Now, of course, one way to get around that is to defragment the drive, which basically rearranges everything so it's all nice and contiguous again. And to a lesser extent, that affects reads. You know, reading, anything that prevents the head from moving is going to give you optimum performance. So just a quick review of, with mechanical drives, what happens and why you may want to do something called a defrag.
So, John, let me ask a question. I've heard on Macs that fragmentation isn't an issue and that's somehow handled automatically.
Some of it is. I can find the articles. We can put them if we have notes for this this effort here. Mac OS X does some level of defragmentation behind the scenes. It's not a total solution, but certain files that it deems important, it will make an effort in the background to try to defragment them and put them in an area of the drive that it can get to quickly. And I used to be of the opinion that, yeah, just let the OS take care of it. So, but it's not a total solution. So it's true that to some level it tries to do this, but if you really want to do a good defrag, and, you know, I used to, probably because I had bad experiences, mostly on the Windows side, I really was nervous about defrag, because the problem with the defrag is that it's like taking a jigsaw puzzle and throwing all the pieces in the air and then hoping they all fall back down again. The problem is, seriously, if
some of them stick to the ceiling,
if something bad happens in the process, you are in deep trouble. And I've had more than one, and again, this is in the early days using Windows machines, if something interrupts the defrag process, you could have a brick of a hard drive.
Yeah, that's why they say
because it's making some very intimate changes. It's saying, all right, you that's over here, well, you go over there, and then let me change the part of the disk that tells the disk where stuff is, and let's hope that doesn't get interrupted. So the only thing, though, as of late, like the utility I like to use is Drive Genius, and I've done some defrags with it, and it's handled it well.
Do you tend to back up before you defrag, John?
you guessed what I was going to say. Is before you do it, a defrag, again, gets very intimate with some low-level stuff on the hard drive, and there's the possibility you could screw things up. So I would say yes, you definitely want to make a backup of your. You should. Everybody should always be making a backup, especially Mac users. If you're not using Time Machine, you're insane.
I'm not using Time Machine. Okay, but let's knock it off.
No, but we've done that for a long time.
I've got reasons. Okay, so now we understand what's going on with the spindle hard drives. With or what do they call it? Rotational. What about with the SSDs? What's the story there?
All right, the story with the SSDs is a little different. There are parallels, though. So the ideal situation is that you have an SSD where no data has been written to.
Okay.
And when you write, you get maximum performance. Now, what happens, though, and this is digging a little bit into the way that Mac OS X and pretty much other operating systems work. So you're writing files, that's great. At some point, you're going to start deleting files. Now, the way operating systems work, for the most part, unless you're used, well, I'm not going to go down that tangent, but the way that operating systems work is when you delete a file, they're not really, and this applies to both types of drives, at least by default, they're not really deleting the data. They're not scrubbing it with an eraser and deleting it. What they're doing is telling the part of the disk that keeps track of things on the drive, all right, you know what, that part of the disk, if you need to use it again for something else, go ahead, but it's not actually scrubbing the data.
Sure. Sure. It's just the pointer to the file has been shut off
right,
so that it won't go right there.
Right. So there's a big directory of what's on the disk. And when you delete a file, typically what happens is that directory, the entry for that file gets marked or that block or portion of the hard drive. It says, okay, if anybody needs to use this in the future, you can use this.
But the old bits from the file remain.
Yes. Is that the data is not, unless you're using, I'll go on the tangent, that there are products that do secure erase and stuff like that, and they will, though you take a performance hit, but they will scrub that part of the disk. And actually, I believe in Mac OS X, there is a secure delete feature, which does. Now, you're going to take a performance hit, of course. If you're not just marking something as gone, but you're also writing over the old data,
that's gonna
then,
take
you're going to take a performance
sure.
hit. Sure.
Okay.
So here's what happens, though, with SSDs. And from the research that I've done, the problem is that one is that it's doing this. It is marking it as the ideal situation for an SSD, just like a mechanical drive that I mentioned, is that the block has never been used. And what happens, I'm sorry, let me go back. When an SSD, when something is marked as, okay, you can use it again, then what you call it is you call that a dirty part of the drive. And then it is dirty. It has old, yucky data there.
I love it when you talk dirty, John.
Yes, and I am talking dirty. Now, the problem is, and here's the situation. When somebody comes to use that part of the disk again, the thing is an SSD is fundamentally different from a mechanical drive. And the other problem is that the size of the smallest piece of information that the drive can deal with versus what the SSD can do, or I'm sorry, the operating system versus what the SSD can deal with is different. So for example, Mac OS X uses something called Mac OS X Extended as the partition format, and that typically deals with data in 4K chunks.
4 kilobyte chunks.
Yes, 4 kilobyte chunks. Now, okay. The thing is, SSDs, for the most part, deal with data, at least when you're erasing, and here's the key, in larger chunks, and this is where you run into the problem, typically 512K. Okay, well, that's a big difference. So here's the problem. Say I mark a part of the drive as, all right, you can use it again. And then somebody comes along and says, hey, I want to write to this. What happens is that the OS says, okay, well, we'll write something here, but the drive says, whoa, 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 this is dirty. And by the way, I can only understand data in 512K chunks or larger chunks. So what I'm going to do, even though I understand what you're telling me to do, Mac OS X or Windows or whoever, what I got to do is read back the data in this bigger chunk, erase the entire cell, and then write back the unchanged old data plus the new data that you want me to write.
So that, John, that's reading the data into some cache, some memory.
Right.
But not disk, but some RAM?
Yes. So I think the OS or the drive itself may cache it. So the thing is that you have two drastically different operations. If you're writing to a part of the drive that's fresh and new, then it just writes it. But if you're writing to a part of the drive that is dirty, then what you're doing is not just a write, but you're doing a read, then an erase, then a write, and you may be rewriting back data that had to be read in before that hasn't even changed, but because we have this disparity in the size of the data.
So it's erasing the block and then writing back everything that was in that dirty block plus the stuff you wanted to write?
Well, it's reading, because it has to take the bigger chunk of data, read it in, then do an erase, which zeroes everything out.
Okay.
Then write back not only the new data, but the older data that it just read in. So you've just created this huge amount of extra work here, and that, based on my understanding, is why the SSDs slow down. Now, one solution.
Let me take a scenario here.
Go, sure.
So if, let's say I buy a 300 gig SSD and I immediately fill the entire drive, beginning to end, then every single operation would be slow, because it would always have to erase a block or read a block, erase it, and put it back every time I did anything, right? So it's not actually time that causes these to go bad. It's the rate at which you fill up the clean blocks and make them dirty.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So if you never exceed the capacity of the drive, then you're golden, because you're always going to be. But most of us, because of the relatively small size of the SSDs, which is one reason I haven't made the jump, is that, I mean, right now, I think, you know, ones that are affordable by mere mortals are maybe 128 gigs or maybe 256. I'm looking at a 256 right now, but it's pretty expensive. It's about $500.
Remember the thing I did? I'm loving that solution of putting in the SSD for the boot drive and for the apps. It's so good. I'm seriously trying to figure out some reason I need that new MacBook Pro. It's a 2.5-year-old machine, and I'm like, I don't know, it runs great.
And it doesn't have an SSD.
Well, it has an SSD as the
optional.
Oh yeah. Oh, you mean the new one? Yeah.
Right.
So I'm confused by something though. It seems to me you said if we never fill the capacity, let's say again our 300 gig, or we can't afford that, our 128 gig SSD that we might be able to afford if we sell a kidney. Even if I never fill that, let's say I only fill 100 gig, I'm deleting and putting back data all the time. So I really am.
No, you bring up a good point.
Touching it all.
All right. So I'm going to take that back. So if the total amount of data that you need to write and erase never exceeds the capacity of the drive, then you're cool. All right. No, you bring up a great point, because not only are you probably deleting files, but the OS is, and this may lead into what we're doing, and we may talk about, but the OS is behind the scenes always creating and deleting
cache files and all those things you're supposed
exactly.
to clean up. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's always activity on the disk.
So it seemed to me you'd be making things dirty constantly. You'd either be accessing dirty blocks. Well, but you'd be accessing those already dirty blocks or getting to the clean ones. So that 20 gig I've got free on my 128 gig drive, that's already been written to too.
So I have a question here. John, sure. Is the default to first access clean SSD memory, and then only when you run out of that does it access the dirty already written to portions?
I
would think that should be a good strategy for maximum speed.
I agree with you. I don't believe that's how. I don't think the operating system is smart enough to know that.
And the SSD controller isn't?
I don't think. Because with the SSD controller, and here's another aspect of SSDs. So the thing that SSDs want to do is, and this really complicates things. So whereas there's really not a downside with a mechanical hard drive or rotational to using the same part of the disk repeatedly, with SSDs, this is a big problem. Not so much reading. Because SSDs, eventually what's going to happen to an SSD versus a mechanical hard drive that's just going to roll over and die. And what happens to SSDs is the Achilles heel of an SSD is at some point the memory cannot be written anymore. All memory has a limited amount of write cycles, at least the flash memory or the NAND memory. So what these things do, which complicate matters, is that they do something called, I think it's called write leveling, which is behind the scenes, even though the disk is going to say, well, yeah, write to sector 1, 2, 3, 4. The SSD is going to say, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. But, and I think they call it write leveling. Internally, what the SSD is doing, the thing is, if you repeatedly write to the same memory cell with the same address on an SSD, eventually you're going to burn it out. And that's
you'll wear out the bits.
Exactly. No, it's true. So what's happening, so whereas the OS may be saying, yeah, write to sector 1, 2, 3 again, the drive may be saying, well, yeah, okay, sure, but I'm really going to internally ignore what you said there, and I'm going to use... So they call this leveling, because the thing is that their goal is to even out to basically distribute what cells in the SSD are written to. Because the thing is, as I mentioned, once a cell in an SSD has been written to a certain number of times, it's done. It's gone.
Yeah.
Oh. So I think what they do is initially, yeah, it's sad.
I just gave up a kidney for this.
Well, initially, what I think
you got another one now.
Is as they die, similar to a mechanical SSD, as they die, it's going to start mapping them out, but eventually it's going to get to the point where you're reaching the right limit of the memory. Now, from what I understand, unless you have a horrible failure, the drive is never going to be unreadable, but eventually the drive, because of the nature of the memory in there, is going to be unwritable. So this complicates things because you have this mapping between the area of the disk that the OS is saying you should use and the drive attempting to even things out so that you don't burn it out.
I wonder how long that takes for the average user to start wearing out his bits or her bits. The drive's bits.
The drive's bits, yeah. I don't have it in front of me. This is a constant area of research with these drives. I did have actually, so right now one drive I'm looking at, which looks to be the cream of the crop right now, is a Samsung 470 series SSD, which I'm reviewing, and I have to send it back to him. But I've been looking at it, and the performance is stellar. It's, you know, personally for my taste, a bit too pricey, and it's 256 gigs, which for what I use my MacBook Pro for is not enough.
So okay, if all of this is are just facts of nature, you know, physics that of the way these things work. Why do they? Why does OWC say the Mercury Extreme Pro doesn't slow down like the other ones do? They have little graphs and they show how it doesn't slow down.
All right, I haven't looked at let me address that question. So let me address it in a couple of ways. So number one, I found this group, and you saw the report in the notes here, and we'll link to it. But it's a www.bit-tech.net. And this is a group that did what appeared to be some pretty thorough evaluation of SSD performance. And it was funny because when they did it on Windows machines, they came up with terrible numbers. Once the drive had been written to enough times where it started getting into this whole read, erase, write cycle, the performance in many cases plummeted. Then they tried to run it on Mac OS X, and they said, you know what? This is kind of weird for whatever reason. Now the big difference, of course, not that just it's a, you know, Windows versus Mac, but I think it is because you're talking a different file system. You know, you're talking NTFS versus what we call Mac OS X extended partitioning, and there's all the nuts and bolts of the file system. But they came to the conclusion, number one, that Mac OS X, for whatever reason, with the drives they tested, are not as susceptible to drastic degradation in performance versus Windows. So there are two ways that you can get a drive so the performance doesn't degrade. So one is if you have a firmware that kind of takes care of this stuff in the background that makes these dirty cells undirty.
As you're erasing them? Or as you're releasing them?
Right, because some benchmarks that I've seen suggest that, and another site that I went to that has a lot of good info, and I'll dig it up, it's not in the notes right now, Tom's Hardware. One thing is you can build into the firmware kind of a background utility that kind of cleans things up to increase the... And they actually had, in one of their benchmarks, they said, you know what, if we just took this drive and just let it sit for 30 minutes, and then we tested it again, it got better.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you could see a trade-off in increasing your delete time a little bit by cleaning up the bits as you delete a file, but saving your write times for when those bits are used again.
Mm-hmm.
And you might want to make that trade. You know, take a little longer to delete a file, but know that when you write, it'll be fast.
Right.
Or so does it in the background?
Right. So one way I've seen is that the firmware kind of takes care of it. The other thing, and this is something that everybody's been talking about, is something that you guys have probably heard of. But if you haven't, it's called TRIM. And it doesn't stand for anything. It actually is a proposed command for SSDs that an operating system can issue. Basically saying, you know what? Take care of all this garbage, you know, all this dirty garbage in the background, and just kind of deal with it. So Now, right now, Windows 7 supports it. Mac OS 10 does not. So Windows 7, and my understanding is that when you should call this, and based on our prior discussion, when you should call this trim command is when you do something like deleting a file.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is you, so in addition to marking, the OS marking, all right, well, you know, these spaces on the drive are available, you issue this trim command, which does a better job of cleaning up than we talked about before, versus the, oh my gosh, this is dirty, now I have to do a read, erase, write.
Right. So there's late-breaking news on that, John. 10.7 Lion does support trim, and Don McAllister confirmed that recently.
Excellent. Yeah, I heard about that too.
So as
if,
right
if
now,
I knew what you were talking about, you know, like if there was even a developer preview of that available, because if you're part of the developer program, you're not supposed to talk about these things. But
better erase Don's name from that. I want to back you guys up for a second, though. I've been trying to get a word in here. Before you start talking about trim, I kept searching for the graph that I saw that used to be on the OWC site that showed that the Mercury Extreme didn't slow down. But in doing that, I found two things. I found a site called digiloidtools.com, and they've got a disk tester / recondition tool that'll go through and apparently recondition your SSD. But they actually very specifically say, most solid-state drives respond to this treatment by cleaning up and defragmenting themselves. Some top-quality enterprise-grade drives do not need reconditioning, such as the OWC Mercury Extreme. And that's the one I bought. So I thought, well, wait a minute, why would that be? And I found another site called hardwarecanucks.com. You got to love them Canadians. It says in there, independent simulation tests by leading drive performance experts confirm the OWC Mercury Extreme Pro's SSD's ultra-efficient block management and wear leveling technologies are able
to
eliminate virtually.
That's what it's called, wear leveling.
Yeah. So that's what you were talking about in the firmware, actually doing this maybe real time, or like whenever you're not talking to the disk, it goes, okay, let me clean some crap up here while you're just fooling around on Twitter.
Exactly.
You know, what it's starting to sound like is maybe some of the older generation SSDs suffered from this, but the newer ones may have built-in software, firmware, whatever, in the controller to take care of this problem.
Newer or more expensive.
Well, yeah, maybe the higher-end
ones.
You know, John, I looked at that report you referred to from TechNet, and one thing they noted at the end was that the SSD drive they were looking at on a MacBook Air, and this was the older generation with the optional SSD, didn't actually have a very good performance from the start. It wasn't a higher end, data transfer rate.
Okay.
And that may have been one of the reasons they didn't see much degradation, because it wasn't blindingly fast from the outset. So the degradation may not have been as noticeable for a slower transfer rate. I don't know why you wouldn't still see an effect of the, additional read and write back again, but that was one speculation. I haven't seen any tests yet, though, for the new SSDs in the new MacBook Airs or the other MacBooks that are available, MacBook Pros. Have you seen any benchmarks or tests with the new one?
I thought, I think Macworld did a general benchmark of the new some of the newer MacBooks, which we just saw that came out with the Thunderbolt.
Right. And I understand those SSDs, well, and I see it in my MacBook Air, do perform very well.
Yeah, it's.
So I think we're to the point where we do understand how this works and why we've got these different reports. And I guess one of the things to tell people is that it does matter what kind of SSD you get. That trying to find the cheapest one might not necessarily give you what you're looking for.
Right.
The observation that I have, though, it depends on what you're looking for. I mean,
well, everybody's looking for speed, right?
Well, that's to me, that is the benefit of SSDs. It's certainly not bang for the buck. Because, yeah, as I indicated, no, and it's interesting because, there is an area that I want to explore. So, as I told you, my needs, or at least what I wish I had on my MacBook Pro, is something that, I want a half a terabyte for $100. You're not going to get that in the near future with an SSD, which is why you guys are laughing. Now, if you want the performance, now I definitely
noticed. It's $100 in a kidney.
Right. Now, I definitely noticed when I was testing this, you know, even in this machine, which has a somewhat crippled SATA port, you know, it's 1.5 gigabit a second. I mean, the performance was pretty amazing, mm-hmm. even on an older machine, my 2008 machine. I still think they have a ways to go because the problem is you're dealing with the old way of how operating systems interacted with hard drives. And the problem is the SSD people are trying to either trying to adapt to that pretty much. So either you add this trim command that kind of, you know, lets the OS give a hint to the drive saying, by the way, can you clean up your garbage so when I come back to you, it's not going to be, you know, molasses, which is really what I think trim is. So
when that's working, you won't have to buy the drive that does it in its firmware like the Mercury Extreme.
Well, ideally, you want both. You want an OS that can give the hint to the drive saying, yeah, by the way, I just deleted something. Can you clean that up? Or the firmware may, and I think eventually both will happen.
Okay.
You know, I thought it was interesting that Apple did add trim to Lion because I haven't heard of any reports yet that the Apple, you know, the MacBook Airs and MacBook Pro SSDs do degrade over time significantly. At least I haven't seen that yet, and maybe they're too new. But adding trim would kind of imply that that might be an issue over time. So it's almost an acknowledgement on Apple's part that they would benefit from the use of trim.
Well, I think they're just following the industry. I mean, I don't think there's any downside to trim.
But is it needed? Do the Apple SSDs really need to use it to fix a problem? Or is it there as an insurance policy? I'm curious, if you don't use it, are we going to see degradation? It's nice to know it's there.
Well, like you saw in that report, I think Apple is, again, following the industry, and between the firmware of the drive taking care of it and the trim command explicitly from the OS saying, yes, I just deleted something, so you really should know about it.
I think
they're just trying to keep up with because the drives, like the one I got, the Samsung, they said, we support trim.
Yeah. It may be that some of these drives, non-Apple endorsed drives, don't have this fancy firmware that kind of cleans things up in the background, and then you would benefit from having trim, and therefore they've added it for such drives.
Yeah. So I guess to wrap it up, though, my observation with the little I've done with SSDs is that SSDs will absolutely give you maybe not an order of magnitude, but they're absolutely better performing in nearly all aspects versus a mechanical drive. Especially, and this is the observation I made because I just benchmarked an SSD, the Samsung. I like the Samsung because this one, you know, they kind of quietly introduce it. The thing is, they make, as you probably know, or if you don't, they make memory chips that are controllers that are used in a lot of the other SSDs. So when they introduce theirs, I mean, you on the one hand, you're paying a premium, but number two, you're benefiting from the fact that they're doing everything. They're doing all the components in the drive. So,
yeah.
Hey, I'm going to actually switch topics on us here because I'm afraid my eyes have now glazed over, so I'm going to switch to something even harder. John, I don't know whether we have enough time to really do this one justice, but one of the things that drives me crazy is that when something bad happens, people always say, well, you should check out your crash logs. So I have become quite adept at launching the application called Console that sits in my utilities folder, and then there's a little pop-down thingy in one of those disclosure triangles that says crash logs, and I can go in there and I can say, yes, it was Wiretap Studio that crashed on me. So there I'll pull my Wiretap Studio crash log. And then I see this giant file full of just crapola. What am I supposed to do next? Is that when I mail it to John F. Braun and say, what the hell happened?
I don't know about that. So number one, I want to be specific here because I want to zero in on what you're looking at, Allison.
Okay.
So here I'm gonna go back. So logs are created all throughout the OS. So maybe I could expand this topic a bit if that's okay.
Sure.
So logs are created throughout the OS, and the best place, as you pointed out, is Console. And if you don't know where Console is, well, you can either use Spotlight to launch it, or you can go in your utilities folder, and there's going to be Console. Now, when you first launch console, you may not see a list of things on the left-hand side. If you don't, then you probably want to click on this thing called Show Log List. And then you're going to see a number of categories. So I'm going to expand this topic a bit because it's going to be relevant to what you asked, I think. And you're going to see a number of categories on the left-hand side here that shows all the different type of logs, Allison.
Right.
So one is, and I think this is what you're talking about. So there are a number of categories in console. There's database searches in big caps, diagnostic and usage information, which I think is what you're talking about, and then files. So I think what we want to zero in on is diagnostic and usage information.
So I've been going into files and then crash reporter. Okay, so no, there's
well,
okay.
Well, you can. Well, that's one place. And no, but it's a good place to launch our discussion here.
Okay.
So one place to look. So when something bad happens in Mac OS X, typically what happens is it creates a log of this and it puts it in a part of the hard drive that can be accessed via the diagnostic and usage information part of the console. And if you look at this, you'll see it. So you could click on it. Actually, you could click on so under that major category, you will then see diagnostic and usage messages. And you will see various processes saying what's going on. Now then under that you will see two subheadings. And I think this is where now you gotta be careful because what happens is these eventually, and I'm gonna give you a little secret here. So if you go into console and you go to preferences, you're gonna see a little box that says automatically send an anonymous diagnostic and usage data to Apple.
Okay.
Well, what happens is if there's stuff there and you got that box checked, and what happens is when the OS runs into this the first time, it's going to ask you a question. I don't have the thing initially in front of me, but it's going to say, hey, by the way, are you okay with me anonymously submitting
I've seen that.
All this? And I say yes, because to me, it only helps Apple make a better product.
And I've heard only recently do those reports actually go to the vendor who created the application, that they didn't used to send it to the person who could actually fix it. But anyway, that's a side loop.
Well, my understanding is they actually go to Apple, and yes, by default, they do not go to the developer. The developer has to make an effort to engineer their app to send it to them as well. Or maybe, you know, to beat on Apple and say, yo, you know, it's my app. Can you share that? So, but then under diagnostic and usage information, you're going to see user diagnostic reports and system.
Okay.
And depending on what happened, when you look at these, and this is why I'm saying, you know, some of these, I mean, it is beyond the scope of this discussion to even speculate. The thing is, it's a crash report. You're going to see under the category. So, for example, I'm looking at one here, user diagnostic reports, and I have one report there.
Me too. I have one for Pages. It says Pages crashed a couple days ago.
And, you know, when you look at these, so Allison, you kind of got me by surprise, because the thing is, sometimes it'll explain, like typically, I'll offer you what I've seen in these. Sometimes it may indicate, it may say, I ran out of memory. Like here, I'm looking at one that says, .exe_bad_access.
I get that a lot. Yeah, I have
protection
that
failure.
Yep, I got that one too. So what do I do with that? Steve, have you found one in yours yet?
Yeah, I have a GarageBand crash here, crash report.
And does it say, .exe bad access current protection failure?
Don't see that particular report.
So, John, this is where I go, and I feel like I'm all productive. I'm going to figure this thing out. I'm going to crack the code on what happened and fix the problem, especially if it's a repeated crash.
So, some of these, the thing is, what's in these, so I hate to disappoint you, but some of these will point out, for example, I've worked with some people who have looked at these, and for example, like Safari ones, they will identify a plugin that caused the problem.
Oh,
more often than not, it's Flash. But but it really depends on the application that has crashed and what part has crashed. Like, for example, I'm looking at one here, and it said, oh, crash thread, dispatch queue, com.apple.lib dispatch manager. I don't know. That's something deep in the internals of the OS.
Right.
And the only person that could do something with that. So if you do see within the categories that we talked about, either diagnostic and diagnostic and usage info, if you see a report from a certain app there, if it hasn't gotten to the developer, you may want to give them a ring and say, hey, by the way, your app crashed, and here's the log, and would you like this file?
Okay. Well, I'm thinking like along the lines of where I was getting those bizarre blue screen and then suddenly I was re-logged in crashes. Those seem like a really ripe thing to go look at. And I, you know, it had that exec bad access kern protection fault thing. And but you often say on the Mac Geek Gab, okay, well, have you checked your crash logs? So I was hoping that you had some brilliance about what you're saying. Sometimes you get lucky and there's a piece in there that helps, but more often than not, you look at it dumbfounded like we do.
It depends on who caused the problem. If it's for example, again, a browser plugin, then you can probably nail it and say, all right, well, this plugin, whether it be Flash or whatever, caused the problem. Now, is that the Flash plugin has a bug, or did someone write bad Flash code on the website? In other cases, it's hard to say, because, I mean, I've looked at some of these logs, and some of them will get down to the level of identifying, you know, it depends on who crashed. Like, I've had ones, and there are places that you can look, Allison. You know, so if you want to avoid the console and actually get to the parts of your drive that have these reports, there are a few places you could look. So typically it's either in your home directory /library/logs, and there'll be diagnostic reports. And you'll see the logs, and they'll typically have the name of the application that caused the problem. Another one is, library logs crash reporter.
That's what I'm looking at.
Okay.
Right, so these will have, and it's really up to what the application or, you know, the developer. Well, it's not so much of the developer. I mean, these will happen if they're using the Apple development tools. Then if something bad happens, it'll write to one of these logs. But I guess it's a... I'm sorry to let you down, Allison, but it really... I mean, there are so many different crash logs, and there are different ones that it's really hard to say unless, you know, you can get specific to the application what caused it.
So I mean, it might be a futile effort then.
Well, what it sounds like, John, is at least the crash reporter... is giving you a hint as to what may have caused the problem. What was running that was the source of the problem? Maybe not the root cause, but the application or the plugin or whatever.
Mm. Right, So for example, I'm going to find here. Let's see.
I have an Angry Birds crash log. Actually, it's weird. It's an Angry Birds
on
crash. It's an Angry Birds crash on my iPad. It says, it says it's an itab.crash, and my iPad's name is itab, but it's an Angry Birds crash. That's fun. Oh, there's a whole lot.
Well, you know, I've noticed that. If you look in your home directory, library, logs, crash reporter, slash mobile.
Right. Look at all those.
You found that. You saw my notes there. But anyways, what also happens is that, secretly behind the scenes, I think they may ask you, but... any of your iDevices, if they have a little problem, when you sync them with iTunes, iTunes will suck out and put into that directory so it can be uploaded to Apple if you permit them.
Oh.
Why that happened.
So it could have been that I was playing Angry Birds. Angry Birds crashed, but that crash log got moved into my Mac so that it could go up to Apple?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm glad they're running, and I'm glad they go to Apple, but maybe I should stop opening them and thinking I'm going to find wisdom in them is the answer.
Yeah, I mean, the crash logs, it is, I'm not a good enough developer of Mac OS X software at this point or iDevice software to understand this. Now, but we do have the console. Now, the console, though, is a whole different story, and I don't know if we have enough time to talk about this.
Yeah, we have 24 seconds left. Go ahead.
Are you kidding? Oh, okay.
No. We usually stop for 40 minutes, but that's fine. Keep going.
But to me, the much more useful part of the console. So the console, as we mentioned, will let you look at this section called Diagnostic and Usage Information. Mm-hmm. And if you had a recent crash, that's where you're going to see them. And maybe you'll glean something, maybe you won't. It sounds like you probably won't, because a lot of that is pretty cryptic. But to me, the biggest thing, and sometimes I will honestly, I mean, a lot of times I'll have the console open. But when you're in the console, there is a section called Database Searches, and there is a heading All Messages. And I like looking at this a lot of times, because what you'll see here is messages, and they're not necessarily errors. A lot of times they're just informational messages from various applications running on your system. And
I've got a great example of that, John. So Allison, help me because I've got a hard drive that takes forever to spin up. So I go to do something, Ooh. And I'm waiting 10, 15 seconds before I can do anything on my machine. So she got me a little application that pings the hard drive every 10 seconds just to keep it awake. And now in the console, what I'm seeing is every 10 seconds, a little message coming up saying, throttling respawn, we'll start in 10 seconds. This thing is just full of those.
Oh, that's
every
funny.
10 seconds, that message is coming up in the console.
I could probably change that frequency, huh?
Well, you know, that... Well, actually, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because that is a specific message that worries me.
Uh-oh. Well, tell me.
And, you know, let's talk about some of the messages we see here. But when I see that, what that indicates to me is that there's a job in probably one of the either launch agents or launch daemons directories that's not starting up properly. Does this say something like POSIX... No, when I see errors, and this is one thing, when I see in the console, when I see a respawn error, what that indicates to me is there's a disconnect between what the OS has told, what the OS thinks it should be running, and what is there or not there.
Yeah.
Of error actually causes me concern, because that's usually a bad thing.
It's tagged with com.seagate.notification.plist, so it's probably the Seagate drive, I'm sure, and how it's being commanded.
Yes. My initial guess there, just based on when I've seen these before, is that there is something in one of your, again, either launch daemons or launch agents folders. Let me bring it up here. We're going live here. Macintosh HD
I'm
Library.
Not sure this is the greatest radio option here to diagnose his disk, but that points right to it, John. Not that I don't want you to help us diagnose it, but maybe we should get off the air for that. But how is a regular human to do anything with that? Because how would we know that that meant something bad?
Well, you got to call... The Mac Geek Gab.
Okay. And you know what? I am perfectly fine with that being the answer to the question, but I've always felt somehow inadequate.
No, we can help you, but I'm going to offer some initial advice here. So what you see when you go to the console and you see all messages, you'll see a number of things. You'll see the date and time the message was initiated. Mm-hmm. You will see the sender of the message. Now, here's the clue as to... And the sender... So what happens is every application potentially can be a sender to the console. You know, console, of course, is going back to the good old days when you actually had a screen or a teletype. Of course, you don't have that really anymore. Well, you have a screen, but not a CRT. But then it says who sent this message. And for the most part, it's going to make sense. It's going to be firewall. I'm looking right now at mine. It's going to be firewall, MD worker, which is actually a spotlight in the background, com, Apple backup D, firewall, Skype. I'm seeing a whole bunch from Skype here. And some of these aren't bad. They're just informational, but some of them are. Like the one you told me, Steve, is one that I think is bad.
Hmm.
And then we'll have PID, which is process ID, which every process in Mac OS X has a process ID. And it may put that in parentheses. It's something you can also see through Activity Monitor. And then you get the message. Now, some of them, again, are just informational. You know, I'm looking right now from the kernel. Oh, wake reason. Why did I wake up? Oh, well, that's because somebody told me. System wake. Oh, I synced with an NTP server to get the time data. Oh, it was off by this many seconds. Oh, I talked to the smart utility. So, you know, sometimes you may want to go through the console and search for, you know, key terms here, like I'm going to do this. So in the upper right-hand corner of the console, you're going to see a little filter area. And like one of the words I like to type in is failed. A lot of apps, when something goes bad, they're going to say, hey, it failed. So you may want to search for failed or error. Or if you think a certain application is misbehaving and you don't know why, then type it in. For example, I'm not going to pick on them too much, though I'm not happy with their latest UI, is Skype. You know, Skype is freaking out. Then when you go into the all messages, which is a catch-all, then type something into the filter field that says, that is the name of the app that you think is causing problems, and you'll probably get some console messages from the app, and maybe it'll help you solve a problem.
Okay, well, it helped on two levels, John. I think I do understand a little bit more what I'm looking at, and I also understand a little bit more that I should set my expectations to perhaps...
Realism.
Realism. To not necessarily consider this mortal human readable, but perhaps Mac Geek Gab readable.
Perhaps. And even then, I've seen ones, you know, like there's a specific folder, panic reporter. When you get a kernel panic, some of those. And I've looked in them, and I saw, the last one I saw was something, and it had, was it SMC? I think it was. But one of the drivers, you know, that handles, I think it was, you know, the motion control and the hard drive, you know, but, you know, when it thinks you're going to drop it. But sometimes it may identify a specific piece of hardware or driver that caused the kernel panic. So that may be useful, maybe not. I mean, when a kernel panic occurs, fortunately in my case, kernel panics are not a regular thing. They happen once in a blue moon, and I wonder why they happen, but they never happen again. But if they keep happening, then you want to look in the specific directories. And
try to find some patterns, maybe, of the same thing repeated in several of them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and specifically for the people that are brave enough to go into the terminal, the two places that you want to look are either your home directory /library/logs or the top level directory of the hard drive /library/logs. And that's where you're going to see all of these logs, including there are subdirectories like crash reporter, panic reporter, hang reporter, which is when
all these nice things.
I want to hang myself now after hearing about all of this.
No, you don't. You want to look in your logs, and you want to.
I kind of do. Hey, you know what? I'm going to have to cut us off, though. We have gone a long time, but I'm really glad to have you on here, John, because I do appreciate your depth of knowledge. That's well beyond anything I have. And Steve, I want to thank you for being here to help interpret what he says for me.
I don't know if I did that, but I did learn something, John. Thank you very much.
All right, John, why don't you tell people, the maybe one or two people on Earth who don't know who you are, give us a plug here.
Well, I'm hoping there are a lot of people that don't know who I am. Anyways, John F. Braun, my main gig is the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Ad podcast, along with my friend Dave Hamilton, and we do a weekly show. We help solve your Mac problems. We share tips. We also have a subscription if you'd like to get extra episodes, which I've been told I should plug, and I just did. But anyways, basically you can go to MacGeekGab.com, check it out. If you'd like to follow me, you can follow me at John F. Braun, my friend Dave Hamilton, who is also a wealth of Mac knowledge, Dave Hamilton on Twitter, and the podcast itself is MacGeekGab on Twitter, and Mac Observer, of course, is Mac Observer on Twitter. So follow any of those, and you'll probably learn a thing or two.
All right, John, I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Well, that was a blast. I love John F. Braun. Everybody in the chat room's going, Chad, I left John F. Braun. You're famous, John. They love you. Anyway, I had a good time, and I'm really glad I had Steve there for the adult supervision, as I said. I think Steve helped bring it down to the level that I could understand, translating a little bit, but John does a great job of that, too. Well, that's going to wind it up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. ScreenSteps from ScreenSteps.com, Smile from SmileSoftware.com, and of course, the venerable Honda Bob from HDABob.com. Don't forget to keep sending in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at Allison@Podfeet.com, and you can always follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/Podfeet. If you want to join in the fun of the live show and be one of the official No Silla Castaways, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.